listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center, and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
I've got a bunch of slides here. I always go back and forth on whether or not I want to do slides, and I always end up doing them because I'm a little more focused that way. What I'm going to talk about is really big, and parts of it we've found in our group and in Project VRM and the volunteers that have contributed to it, is that it often takes three different conversations before people start to get it. So I'm going to try and beat that today and try and get it done in one. So. How many people here are Comcast customers, I'm wondering? How many people like being Comcast customers? I thought so. Okay. We're already there. Okay. So we all understand Mona Shaw. Mona Shaw was famously took a hammer to her local Comcast office for reasons we all understand. And on January 8th, right after that, they made promises that we're going to make it all better and the rest of it, you know, and we actually love our customers and so forth. And this is interesting because in January, there was a piece in Wired by Rob Bishizda, who reported on this guy, the CEO of Comcast, Roberts, something Roberts, doesn't matter, promising 100 megabits on cable and Project Infinity and so forth. It's a pretty straight-ahead piece. He's a reporter for Wired. And then not long after that, he puts up a blog post that says, Comcast, please stop bugging me for money. I don't owe you any. And he actually tricked up this because even though he's a reporter and a responsible journalist, we all know what that's about. So there's a thesis here, which is that the real problem is that Comcast actually can't fix itself alone. Nobody on the sell side can. There are fundamental problems that can't be solved just by sellers alone. So another problem is loyalty cards. We're all burdened by these things. A friend of mine, who's actually pretty active in Project VRM, actually has like a janitor's key ring that's just festooned. It's like a necklace filled with loyalty cards. And these are actually the green stamps of our time. I'm probably not too many other people in the room old enough to remember green stamps, but David, a few people raised their hands. Green stamps actually started in 1882, I forget the name of the company, but they peaked in the 50s and 60s. And in 1966, the largest single publication run of anything in human history was a green stamp book. And every single store had green stamps. So what was the differentiator there? You had to have green stamps. It was like you had to have a fedora in the 50s. You just had to have one. So the bad thing about loyalty cards is they actually leveraged something that's really broken about e-commerce. They looked at what was happening on the web, and they copied what wasn't working, which is that you have to become a member and sign in to buy anything. This is a flaw on the net. This is like something that hasn't worked out yet. We shouldn't have to do that kind of stuff. But they went and put that in the grocery store. So it just slows things down. They inconvenience the customer and they cause friction at every possible point. And they're actually stupid about the most essential data. The whole idea behind the cards, or part of the idea behind the cards, one idea is you increase what they call switching costs. You know, we won't let the customer switch to something else. Never mind that every other place has a loyalty card too. But that we're going to collect data on people. And most of the time, the data consists of getting a discount on the thing you just bought, which only annoys you more. But there's nothing we're actually stupid about. So here's a case in point that's actually kind of close to home, which is the Harvard Coop. You'll notice that I actually am, you know, I have nothing in checkout right now. It's a nice place. I love shopping there ever since I've come to Cambridge. It's really great. Until I got tired of playing plus 10% for not belonging. So, okay, I'll break down and actually pay. Because you're not really getting a discount if you're a member, right? I mean, you're actually paying more if you're not a member. So, but joining any loyalty program is a pain in the butt. Here's theirs. I actually tried filling out the thing, and that didn't work. And then I went online a bunch of times, and I kept filling these things out, and I just kind of gave up. It failed the first few times. It finally did succeed. I'm a member, which means I now have to care about all this jive. You know, your address book, you know, what are you going to do with your addresses? Here are your other cards. Here's university data. Why isn't this stuff collected? Why don't I already have that? Why do I have to enter this over and over again? And, you know, so why do you fill this junk out? And why do we do it for every relationship? Because they aren't really relationships. They're just my data in somebody else's database. And this gets replicated over and over again. This is the way loyalty systems work. So another failure, which is... By the way, this is like fun drive time. Keith here is in the middle of it. But how many people here listen to public radio? like everybody, right? How many people give to public radio? About half. How many would give more if it was real easy? How about if they didn't have pledge drives at all? Okay, so there's a little evidence to take back home. Okay, so this is probably unfair because this is MIT's little station. The main thing I like on it are just these two programs called Lost Highway and Backwoods with John Funke on Saturday morning. Absolutely fabulous program. I'd like to give money for that, but how or where? I go to their website, and down here it says fundraising drive. I click on that, and I get, oh, your fund drive is actually over. So what do you do? So I look again, and there's this thing called underwriting. I go to underwriting, and I get all this kind of legalese. Thanks for your interest. I'm going to actually take a scan of some text and stick it up there. So I gave up. Another one is WUMB at UMass Boston, which is a kind of a folk station. I like them. And I actually had a membership there, and they send me an email, renew today, click there. So I click on it and bring on the friction, because when I get there, the cookies need to be able to pledge through our secure server. I have cookies. I enable cookies. Why should they not know I have cookies? So I click on that, and sure enough, I can't. It's not already filled out. I try filling it out. It doesn't work. And I give up on that as well. So the problem in all these cases is something called customer relationship management. That's a big category. Not all of them call it customer relationship management, but that's the basic category that this stuff falls into. If you look up customer relationship management on Google Images, the top thing that will come up is this. I don't even know who it's for. But this is basically the idea that you know, it's not really about relating. You're being acquired, and you get growth and retention and shareholder value creation, marketing orientation, information technology, innovation. But it's really about marketing. It's to you. It's not with you. It's not really relating to you. However, it is still a $12 billion business that doesn't work, except by its own metrics, which barely include you, which is why Mona obeyed Howard Beale. We all see Network at some point, you know, where I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Well, Mona didn't, and she went after Comcast. So the problem is that most big businesses still think the best customer is a captive one. This is the default, actually, in big business. This is the way we've been taught to think since industry won the Industrial Revolution. And that's why we talk like this. You know, we acquire, manage, control, and otherwise own these creatures we call consumers, not just customers. A couple summers ago, I was talking with the government relations guy for one of the big box stores, and he talked about, listen, you know, we love our customers. Most of them are women, and most of our executives are women, and we call them guests, and we treat them nice, and we do everything we can to own the customer. And I said, what do you call owning a human being? And he said, oh my God, it's slavery. He said, why do we talk like that? I said, because you're not talking to your customers, you're talking to yourselves. That's what happens, you know. So, and that's why a free market is still this, is your choice of captor. This, by the way, is the, I tried to find a piece in the Wall Street Journal, but there was a Wall Street Journal editorial that was against net neutrality and all those guys that wanted net neutrality because it was against the marketplace. The marketplace is Comcast and AT&T. Right, two captors. That's what they call a marketplace. It's not a marketplace. It's a regulatory protectorate. These guys are zoo animals in that protectorate. But nonetheless, they call it a marketplace. So even though the net is now in the middle of everything, so my position on the net, in addition to being in favor of it, is that I'm pro net, or I wouldn't be here. Is that, you know, we tend to think that at any given time that it's sort of like the end of times because so much cool stuff is there, right? You know, it was funny to me that my 12-year-old kid, when he was about 7, wanted me to look something up when we were driving somewhere. And I said, I can't look it up now. He says, why not? He just assumed you can look up anything. That the net now makes this possible. It's imaginable. But my belief on it is that we're actually about 3 minutes into the Big Bang, and we have a lot of heat and a few light elements and no galaxies. It's really pretty early. Google, no trees grow to the sky. Google's not the final stage of anything. And advertising's not the final stage of anything, which we'll go into in a minute. So what we have to do is prove that a free customer is more valuable than a captive one. That's really what the challenge is here. And this is a challenge going into the Clutrain Manifesto. It's been a challenge for me personally ever since I worked in advertising much of my adult life. There was a time that the top or close to the top high-tech ad agency in Silicon Valley was one called Hodgkin, Simony & Searles. I was the creative director there. So I know advertising, I know how this stuff works, but it was always about capturing the customer. So VRM is about something else. It's about vendor relationship management, and that's the project we've started here at the Berkman Center a couple years ago, and it has quite a community around it now. So to review what that is, VRM is how customers anywhere in the long tail, there's your long tail. Say Hugh, draw me a long tail, and he draws that. That's pretty cool. And create and manage real relationships with vendors or with any organization. It doesn't just have to be with vendors. It could be with your church. It could be with the government. A guy named Britt Blazer, who's spoken here before, who some, a lot of you know, is working on something called government relationship management. So just relating to any organization, but not just on their terms, on yours. So it's the reciprocal of VRM. The idea is not to fight CRM, rather, but it's actually to work with it. So provide ways for customers to drive vendors and not just to be driven by them. So with VRM, we can relate for real. At least that's the idea. That's what we're working on. So here's a key insight and a key purpose that we have. With VRM, the individual is the point of integration for his or her own data. In other words, I need to be the one. I know more about my life than anybody else does. I know more than any company can guess at or give me a form to fill out, right? So, and that information is actually potentially useful to vendors if I actually have a real relationship with them. And also the point of origination for what's done with it. So those two things, being the point of integration for your own data and the point of origination for what's done with it. And here's various vendors we can relate to. So with Project VRM, we have actually a very active and growing community with hotbeds in Europe and here. These are just a few shots from, that was at an Internet Identity Workshop last year. This was in Brussels. J.P. Rangaswamy, who's a friend of the center, is at one end of that. This is in a basement in the U.K. This is Adriana Cronin-Lucas, who's running VRM hub meetings every month and sometimes more frequently in the U.K. This is in Holland. I gave a talk last year at something called Mobile Monday, and because of the interest in VRM, 500 people showed up for that thing. This is a conference we had, actually a workshop we held last summer here in Pound in the law school. 60 of our core people showed up. So there are people working on different things, and I can't cover all of them, but I'll kind of touch on the high points. First of all, VRM is an open source project at its heart. There are some commercial projects in it. There are some things that are proprietary. Even there, we're looking for ways to open source components and standards. And since there are already over half, that should say half, a million open source code bases out there to work with, we're making use of some of those and creating more of our own. And these are just some of the people working on it. This is Keith Hopper, who's right here, and Joe Andrew, who has something called Switchbook, which is a new kind of search on the West Coast. Kevin Marks, who's one of the fathers of microformats and also running Open Social at Google. We have several Google. This is Ben Laurie, who's another programmer at Google. Adriana Cronin-Lucas, who I mentioned before. Ian Henderson, who's probably, I think, is one of the world's living authorities on CRM. Very, very experienced guy who's got a community interest corporation in the UK working on a data store for VRM. Drummond Reed, who's the father of a technology that's basically the data web called XRI, XDI. Asa Hardcastle, who's here in Great Barrington, who's participating in. And this is just some of the people that are involved in this. It's a very active community going on. And here's some of what we want VRM to do. So I'm going to run through these. We can go back and visit some of them. I think the biggest one, and it's one that I've talked a good bit with Richard Dale here about, is managing our own healthcare data. It's a tall order, and it's very long term, and there are some great people, especially around here, already working on it, for example, with personal health records. I don't want to say that this is the VRM community. I think that this is one of those areas where we can add some forward momentum or some weight to efforts that are already going on. This is one of my personal favorites. It's also somewhat Sisyphean, but I think it would be a fun thing to be able to do, which is issue a personal RFP. That's a request for proposal. It's a business term. When Boeing wants to order tires, they send out an RFP to the tire makers. I want to be able to do that on my own for what I may want. So for example, and I did this for the group in Holland, send a message saying, you know, I need a 200-watt 220 to 110 converter in Amsterdam on a Sunday afternoon. Or I want a stroller for twins in Cambridge. this afternoon. I've got the money to pay for it. It's money left on the table right now, and it's not really being, I mean, there's some things like Craigslist that handle some of it, but we want to be able to do this in a more open way outside of anybody's silo. And with selective disclosure, not giving away any more information than is required. If I want a stroller here this afternoon, they don't actually need to know anything other than I've got the money. That's actually the relationship we have with stores when we walk in. Why shouldn't we have it on the web? This is a big one, and I wish Renee Lloyd was here because she's working very hard on this. She's a former fellow here at the center, and a number of people are working on this one, which is assert useful terms of service. So instead of this stuff, which we have, which always give all advantages to the seller, and nobody ever reads, and we always accept, you know, I don't have the rest of that. Let's go back on that one. Go backwards. Is assert our own terms of service. You know, when I walk into a store, because I dress nicely, which I'm trying to throw you off on today, by the way, by dressing up a little bit, it's very abnormal for me. Why not be able to assert our own terms of service? And that's a big one, and I'd love to work more with law school people and others on that one. Create a new business model for free media. This is what I'm going to unpack because this is close to home both geographically and in terms of the time that I'm putting into it and Keith and some other people here in town. And that's a business model for free media that isn't advertising. Everybody wants advertising to pay for everything, but this is not about advertising. And free media include, first, non-commercial broadcasting, public radio, for example, but also blogs and podcasts and music, which I think is the big one, and anything that's either free on purpose or too easy to steal, as the RIAA is inclined to call it. And we're starting with public media on that one. And we have a model we're calling Pay Choice. It's a name we're going to change because it also belongs to a payroll company. But the idea is that we should be able to, you know, any individual should be able to pay as much as they want for whatever they want, whenever they want, and wherever they want, on their own terms as well as those of sellers. And now this is for free media right now. This isn't just for everything, but for stuff we're getting for free. If the friction is low, if it's easy, then let's do it. So here's where we plan to see it first. So here's the public radio tuner. The public radio tuner is something we're involved with, the Berkman Center, associate through its association with Jake Shapiro and the people at PRX and with the rest of what I jokingly call the five families of the public radio mafia, primary of which is NPR. But the public radio tuner, which is showing up first on the iPhone, how many people have it? I'm just curious. Public radio tuner. Well, you're among the, 1,300,000 so far, something like that? 1.3 million have downloaded this so far. There's KQED in San Francisco. This is my radio. This is a radio now. This is what radio has become. It's not going to all go onto the cell system immediately, but the fact that AT&T, Apple drove a deal with AT&T for free data, I don't care how much of that I'm using here in the U.S. at least. So I can use that all I want. I've listened to it a great deal already, but I would like to be able to pay for some of that, what I'm listening to on here. How can we do that? So it's one of the things we're working on. So VRM informs CRM. So the idea is that listeners and viewers will bear their end of the relationship burden with stations, and relationship can be enlarged to mean far more and include far more than just the membership that right now consists of them turning off programming for 2 weeks, pleading poverty, and sending you a cup if you send the money, and then the rest of it. So relating will have its own symbol. This is something we've worked on a bit. We're calling it the R button. And what it can say is, I want to pay what I want, and or I want to relate on my terms and not just yours. And this is my code's way of letting your code know that, even if you're not listening yet. And it's how VRM meets CRM. And there's a lot of work to do on this. It's still early. But it can represent different states. For example, you know, an intention to buy or to relate, an intention to sell on the sell side. But the deal there would be to relate on the customer's terms and not just yours as a vendor. Or an existing relationship. You run across it in this state. It means you already have a relationship. That is not a finished thing, by the way. This is still wide open, and I'm just using some of the graphics we're talking in terms of. And these are a few ways it might look. And again, these are old drafts that we used for an earlier conversation. But the idea is that you'll start seeing something that looks like this on the iPhone, and that will mean something that you can relate to. So back to the title question, which is what happens when customers get real power. So if we take some of this stuff we're working on now with Project VRM and look forward to what this does to the economy, the larger economy, where customers actually have more power than they do now, and we don't have to go to these silos in order to relate. So what happens? So first of all, I think customers are going to get their own pricing guns, but they won't be able to price everything, but the seller won't be the only ones holding these things. Second, customers and vendors will both get to wear matching rings or magnets. That's what these things represent, by the way. There's symbolically, they're two magnets facing each other. Whatever we call them, relationship will become a fact and not just something that is talked about as marketing jive inside of companies. And the intention economy will get real because it's based on what customers actually want rather than the attention economy of guessing what customers want. And here we're swimming up a really strong tide. Most of the conversations I have with people who have not heard about VRM before almost always go to, well, Google does fabulous things with advertising. They've improved advertising all over the place. They've made it accountable. It's so much more efficient than it used to be. We can make advertising better and better and better and better. And the problem with that is that it's still guesswork. It's still just it still has waste. It's moved the waste off of print and ink and billboards and places like that into giant server farms and to the back of your eyeballs and to places on the sides of into server cycles and the rest of it. It's still guesswork. Doesn't mean it goes away, but if we can eliminate guesswork by telling vendors exactly what we want, things change. So, or driving customers to want stuff, because that's a big part of what the attention economy is about. And I think the advertising bubble will burst. I think there has been a bubble there for some time. It won't go away. We'll always need some. It's just that it won't be the communications method of first resort or the only business model that comes to mind. It's interesting to me that when we wrote the Clutrain Manifesto in 1999, it was at the height of the bubble. It was really at the height of the dot-com bubble. And like around this time through the summer, biggest IPOs of all time happened that year in 1999. And at that time, the whole thing was advertising will pay for everything. And then the bubble burst. And then the second bubble came along. We know it was the housing bubble, but there was also a bubble in the internet space as well, and advertising this time did pay for everything, thanks to Google and to a lesser extent some other companies. And what that did is it made us think, well, advertising is going to pay for everything, but it won't. And Clutrain will finally be right. So let's talk. That's the compressed version, and we can go to Q&A or Q&Q. What's the IRC say? I don't want to know. Get the hook.
So thank you, Doc. And
I made it. Yeah, we got time.
Yeah. We usually tell speakers figure 20 minutes, 30 minutes. It's rare for a speaker, especially one who is covering such a broad swath, to make it within such time. So we have lots of time for conversation.
Yes, I've heard of that.
Go ahead.
Senator Old Buffalo once.
Yeah. A naive question. You mentioned Craigslist. What about eBay? Seems to embody a lot of these characteristics.
eBay does. So part of the idea here is that we don't want to... There are lots of sites that do some of this. So why should we only have sites? Why should we only have single services? Part of the idea here is to make the customer independent of all of those. I mean, right now, your eBay reputation is only inside eBay. You leave eBay... And you're stuck. It's what we've done, where we are with business is kind of where we are before the internet was around, when we had nothing but LANs and big online services like AOL and CompuServe and the rest. Your AOL email wouldn't talk to your CompuServe email. The pile of stuff you had here wouldn't go there. We still have that with business. It would be nice, it would be ideal, we think, to be able to move, move your eBay reputation somewhere else, or have a reputation that exists aside from that, or not even bother with reputation at all. Just have the ability to, we call it service portability or substitutability, to be able to, in the same way as we substitute one bank for another, or we substitute one insurance company for another, we should be able to substitute one of those services for another. Having it only come from eBay, being able to only sell on eBay, is too narrow. So that's the belief. Whether we may succeed at that, we don't know. Yes. Sure.
So what will be the method of conveying your desires, what you want to pay for it. Is it going to be a third-party service, nonprofit?
Okay, they're
keep that data on their computers.
They're is very good. And there so the question is how are we going to communicate our side of this, and how what other services can come along to help that out? Would that be fair?
Yeah. What's the VRM magnet?
Okay, the VRM magnet. Okay, so there are two parts to this. One is how do we represent? What goes in the data store? Where is the data store kept? Right. Ideally, it would be something we have. So. In the real world, that's harder. So what we're doing with the public radio tuner, for example, is we're doing something we're calling a listen log. The listen log is going to keep a history of what you've been listening to. The idea being, what was that I heard last Thursday? Who was it that Tom Ashbrook had on Point that was talking about the Middle East? And I'll go back and be able to find that. And downstream, the idea is that we'll be able to value that and make an educated decision on whether or not we want to pay for it. Okay. Ideally, that would sit on our own computers. That would sit in an encrypted form, probably, on our own computers, in a form where only we had access to it. It would be ours, because we're the point of integration for that data. Some of that we're solving with Ian Henderson's personal data store. Some of it is addressed by Adriana Lucas's Mine project. Is called the Mine, M-I-N-E exclamation mark. But the idea is that it belongs to the user. Okay, so that's the first part. So let's say we have that solved and we don't. Okay, so the problem with this is that this has very little room to store data, just to take something that's at hand. And where we put it, only Apple allows itself and its very favored partners to let you transfer data to your computer itself outside of iTunes. So we have to put that data in another place that still belongs to you, but it's kept by a third party. So that gets us to the second part of this, which is that right now there's this term third party, okay, that most of us are familiar with it in business. A third party, generally, say, in the computer platform business, is one that lives on the vendor side. So whoever makes this, you know, this is a you know, third party product. You know, this lives in the iPhone world, okay? If Apple wasn't making iPhones, these guys would be doing something else. That's a third-party business. Tires might be a third-party business for a car maker. We see kind of a fourth-party business, a user-driven business. In other words, a category of new businesses that will come along and old businesses that will be improved. So for example, I've already talked with people at banks about where does this... You know, if for example, this is something we're working on with, we're not working on it yet, but we plan to, with music. So right now with music, the Copyright Royalty Board says the music you hear that's streamed is worth less than a few thousandths of a cent per song. But I like to pay a penny a song. If I want to pay a penny a song, if I want to have the pricing on for a penny a song, and I want to escrow somewhere all the songs I've listened to on online radio, so that can be paid out. Let's say I want to pledge $100 over a period of time to give money to the artist, go straight to the artist. Who's pulling that money together? Well, that might be a bank, that might be some other third party or fourth party. But the point is that there's a category of businesses that will live on the customer side. They'll be serving the customers. We see these as emerging over time. We don't know what they're going to be yet. Some of them will be existing companies. Like banks, but some will be new ones. So that's, again, it's pretty early, so we don't know yet. But we do see these emerging. And we're actually working on what we call an association, probably a chapter-based association, for user-driven services. This is a category we're calling user-driven services rather than vendor-driven services. So stay tuned. And that one.
You kind of create a enum or DNS sort of system with the users, some of the users' information. Is that what you're thinking about?
There are a couple ways that can go, and there are probably many ways that can go. One model is actually RSS. It's an interesting thought to be able to. This is the personal RFP model, to be able to advertise one's own needs. In the same way as advertisers advertise what they've got. That may be an RSS thing. I can publish it, it gets It goes to it's a feed of some sort. Only maybe it's tag based. Only certain subscribers to those tags can read them. Maybe it's done in an anonymous way, so you don't know where it came from. But it, a third party will vouch that it's coming from somebody who can be trusted. Don't know. As for DNS, it's a model, but I don't know if that works. But obviously, we need something new here. Yes, Carly.
You are thinking of a system like that for which kind of business? Because this.
Actually, I can barely hear you. I'm wondering if we could actually turn off these things up here because we're not really using them anymore. Is it possible? Because they make a big fan noise. Yeah. Okay, sorry.
The question is to which kind of a business you would apply a system like that? Because many of these was possible online in service, even in music, jamming, we were discussing that one day. But why? Because there is a cost reduction in this kind of good, because they are digital goods. Mm-hmm. So how do you envision like a system for traditional companies also to be able to reduce cost and then be able to apply a system like that?
So you're saying what do we envision for traditional companies for dealing with this?
Or do you is there a space for this kind of thing in traditional companies or is
just
digital?
Well, I think that in a larger sense, what's happening in slow motion and not very evenly in the spirit of William Gibson's "The Future Is Not Evenly Distributed," companies are going to gradually deal with the fact that customers are going to come at them with more intelligence than they have now. The problem with loyalty cards and all CRM systems is they are very narrow in what they allow in because they're dealing with a mass of customers and at the same time very limited ability to deal with, to sort it all out. So they make a lot of educated guesses about what it is and all that. I think there are going to emerge better ways of dealing with the intelligence that comes in. So I think, for example, let's say we come up with a loyalty card or a loyalty program that's our loyalty program. Here's how I do loyalty. Here are the companies that I pay attention to. A point I wanted to make about the Harvard Coop and about some of these other places is they don't know when I'm not a customer anymore. They have no way of knowing, right? They're busy collecting data on customers, but they can only collect data on people who show up. So I think they're going to be, as customers start to assert more intelligence or inject more intelligence into the marketplace in terms of what they're willing to say about themselves on a very selectively volunteered basis, mostly inside of relationships that they initiate, we're going to see things like fact-checking, you know? I mean, the problem this reporter had with Comcast was that Comcast forgot that they paid him. I've had the same problem with Dish. I mean, my credit was actually damaged to some degree by Dish TV because I parked our account. I even called them up afterwards. I read my account number. They had no record of me. It was their screw-up. So if there's some way in which the customer can actually act as a data backup for the vendor, that would be cool. There are inevitably third-party services that will emerge to help with that, I would imagine. But I don't see a downside for any traditional companies here. I think more intelligence and, more importantly, more goodwill in the marketplace is going to benefit everybody, I think. I think one of the fallacies that we've had is off your question a bit, but it's worth saying that we've had for a long time is that people only shop on price. People only want to cheap out. If that was true, Starbucks never would have happened. You know, there's just a lot of examples to the contrary there. I think people like to relate in ways that work for them. And right now, we've got very primitive ways of doing that. So you were first and then over here. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could situate BRM within two messily overlapping circles. One is the combined circle, so I'm speaking a third one in sort, of micropayments and the tip jars.
Mm-hmm.
But micropayments, people from the beginning have thought that would work, and it sort of generally has not worked out the way people think. So how
right.
do you fit there? And the second is identity management, because there are all sorts
right.
of issues that this is raising and dealing with.
Right. So, okay. So micropayments is one, and identity management is another. It's important to make a distinction between micropayments and what we want to do here, which is micro accounting, right? So if we're keeping track, or the user's keeping track, of what they've been listening to on this, if there's that's, and then when it reaches a certain point, you can have a set point where you say, okay, if I've listened so many hours to WBUR, they get my 10 bucks or whatever it might be. There are lots of different ways one could arrange that, but the point is that isn't that we have tiny little payments that go out all the time, but rather a deliberate system on the user's side that allows them to account for what they do, but then gives them discretion about how it gets spent. And one of the dreams I have with this is that artists, especially, that are played a lot on the radio in cumulatively, but not very much on any given station, will, because we have combined accounting, will be able to get some money out of that. That requires micro accounting, not micro payments. I don't think micro payments has ever worked for anybody other than phone companies, as far as I know, and they've abused the privilege. So that's my short version of micro payments. The other is identity, and there's some history there in my case, because I've had this idea about VRM for a very long time. It wasn't called that until about a year and a half ago. But where, as soon as the net came along, I thought, well, this is going to enable the demand side at least as much as the supply side. That was part of my own motivation for Clutrain, and I think it was part of the thinking behind Clutrain. But I wasn't sure how that would get done. Now, somewhere along the way, there's a guy named Andre Durand, who's a friend and was involved with Jabber, which is open source instant messaging, said to me, you know what, we have to get identity worked out. And identity is personal, it's not corporate. We carry all these identities in our wallets that are given to us. They have our names on us, on them, but they're given to us by other organizations. It's what the DMV tells us who we are, and it's what the Visa company tells us who we are, and it's what some other company tells us who we are, the library, the rest of it. It's not really our identity, it's their identity that has our name on it. And he felt that that was exactly backwards. What we needed to do was be in charge of our own identities and operating as autonomous individuals in the world, and solving that identity problem was core to that. I think that for a while I thought that was necessary but insufficient to the VRM challenge. Now I think it's a separate thing. I think there are cases where identity is not required at all. You know, you don't need it. My wife put this way a while ago, a long time ago. She made two statements that just blew my mind, actually. One was when e-commerce first came along, it was like about 1996, and Amazon was there, and a bunch of other stores were there. She said, why can't I take my shopping cart from one store to another? I think it was a profound thing. You know, we set it up in such a way that everybody has their own shopping carts. But she felt like her shopping list and her shopping cart should be a portable thing. The other was when I started working with the identity, what we then called the user-centric identity movement, she said, I actually want less identity, not more identity. I see that as more identity. I want less identity. She said, when I go into a store, most of the time, I just don't have an identity. I'm just the face that came in. You know, and I hand over some cash, even if you give your credit card. Usually, people don't look at it. The identity that matters there is Visa, not anything else, right? That means this person is trusted. I frank the thing, I put it through, and it goes from there. Adriana Lucas, together with Alec Muffet, who's a star programmer with Sun, are working on this thing called the Mind Project in the UK. The Mind Project is meant to work independently of any identity system. As a matter of fact, they've both been to some of the internet identity workshops and have seen it as, well, that's a good thing, but it's not the only thing. We're going to try and do it without that or make it independent of identity systems. So I think that the whole identity movement, which I'm still involved with, and which frankly got me involved in the Berkman Center in the first place, is a separate thing that overlaps somewhat with this. But the last thing I want to see is VRM considered part of the identity space, because it's really not. It's a different thing. So, does that answer it? Over here.
Yeah, my question is, what happens on the aggregate level? Because a lot of CRM is not really about the relation between the customer, individual customer, and the company, but companies aggregate the data, and they use the aggregated data for recommendation systems, or they get combined into bigger companies like Mosaic, who come up with lifestyle patterns that are used by governments or whatever companies to do consulting. So what happens with that kind of system or business when this system will take over?
I think companies gathering intelligence about us is not going to go away. I think we can improve that a great deal. I had a bunch of slides here I didn't show that were basically my experience with Amazon. Okay, Amazon is the best at this, right? They do recommendations better than anybody. But it's still broken. It's broken in a couple of ways. One is, you know, you have a guest come over, your kids start using your computer, and all of a sudden you get recommendations for a bunch of stuff that's not, does not interest you. Or worse, in the case I would have shown, they'll show one thing. It's like, that's pretty right. That's an interesting book. And you click on that and maybe even add it to your list. And then it all kind of veers off. It assumes, like, for example, I take a lot of pictures out of airplanes. And I'm interested in any book that's already done that, because I have a fantasy about doing a book like that. So they showed me a book that's already done that. And I thought, oh, that's cool. I'll click on that. I'll buy that book. Well, now it assumes I want mapping books. I want books about travel. I want books about other things like that. I don't. It was a very narrow interest that I had at one point in time. And I could go to the trouble of trying to fix that, but why should I? I mean, most of the time I'd rather just tell them, why don't you just tell me the next time one of the books on this subject comes along, you know, or just broadcast that to the world in some way. The problem with all of those is that they, well, there's two actually, there are two big ones. One is that they're still guesswork. It doesn't matter how scientific they make it, they're guesswork and they're often wrong. And the other is they don't know what only you know, right? And they don't know what's outside their system, because their system is inherently narrow. Even a broad company like Amazon that's now selling all kinds of junk and not just books, they're still, they only know what they know about you. They don't know what you know about you or what other companies know about you. So that's why we, you know, focus on the user as the point of origination, you know, integration of their own data and origination for their data, because it's stuff that only you know. So anyway, that stuff will continue going on. I think it'll get better, but it'll never get perfect.
So yeah. One of the things you pointed out was the big monopolies of AT&T and Comcast in particular, and you mentioned customers getting what they actually want versus the companies guessing what they want. Mm-hmm. And I just
at least saying what they want rather than getting it. There's lots of things I want I'll never get, right, too. So.
Yeah, because I just recently upgraded my Comcast service and found out that they, you know, they're actively providing what I don't want because they want to sell me more, you know, on demand and pay
right.
for that, as opposed to giving me a good access to the 100 channels I just paid for.
Right.
But so my question is, do you see this potentially breaking down those monopolies in any way, providing...
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think, well, cable TV is a really good example of something that's almost thoroughly broken at this point. My own experience with that recently is that we have Verizon Fios, which is enviable. It's really a great service. I have 20 megabit symmetrical internet coming to the house. Myself and 32 neighbors share 2-point-some gigabytes down and 1.5 up. That's what they provide with something called GPON. But they're only giving me 20 megabits for internet, which is really what should be the senior thing. I want as much as I can get, right, still. But their TV, you know, it's beautiful. It's actually the best. It looks far better than Dish or far better than the rest of them because they have a much wider data path to send it down. But we don't watch TV. We hardly watch it at all, you know. So I called them up, and in the course of canceling it, I found out what the real price was. Right, you know, just I recommend this to anybody. Try canceling whatever your cable or whatever service is. Take them right to the brink, and then you'll know what they really want to charge. So, they're ready to give me like HBO and Showtime and Stars and all the rest of it, and the DVR and the set, which is also the set-top box, and a bunch of other stuff, and waive a whole bunch of other fees, and give me their extreme thing, which is over 100. HD channels for $47.99. So it's a hell of a deal if you watch TV. We still don't watch TV, so we still gave it up. But the thing is that, and I told him, I said, well, what can we do? I said, well, give me a la carte. I'll pay for it. I'll pay on an a la carte basis. I'll pay for an HBO movie. I'll pay to watch a CNN broadcast. I'll pay to watch the NCAA finals. And that was the one thing I cared about, was the NCAAs, right? I'm an old ACC fan. I lived many years in North Carolina. I like Carolina, Duke, and Wake, and I wanted to see how they were doing. Well, it turns out the NCAA has it anyway. It's on, it, there it is. You know, it, you get it live on the internet, and so we've been watching them anyway. So the first source is there, their partners, you know, the people putting the broadcast together, the producers, are bypassing them already anyway, right? So that's, but I do think they're in a great position because they have a relationship with you. You know, they are out in the field. They already, you already have a billing relationship with them. They can be one of those people operating in the VRM space, but they don't think that way yet. I hope they do, but it's a long shot. Yeah, okay, over here.
So what are the enabling technologies for VRM? You showed the Emerson radio system, and they're not even following best practices in the CRM world.
Not Emerson. Emerson's fine. Okay. You mean ERS? I like them.
Yeah, I like them all.
But they weren't. Yeah.
One of the radio stations, and my on demand has been out for the last 3 months. But one of the radio stations you showed wasn't doing very simple stuff. You know, they should have been able to do.
Website design 101.
So if they're not, if you've got a huge swath of information providers who haven't even figured that out 15 years in, what do you need to provide to enable that toolkit for these? What comes out of Berkman?
Oh, it's really easy. It's the simple answer is money. But the simple answer is like I think at some point if I'm publishing in my own way, my intention to give WMBR $30, and it's laying here. All you have to do is these things on your website to pick them up. I think they'll be motivated to pick it up.
How do you get people outside of this room to publish?
I'm sorry?
But how do you get people outside of this room to publish if no one's picking it up?
We'll see. You know, I mean, how do we get them to 1,300,000 to download one of these? Somebody made it easy. You know,
they made it easy, but the tuner is useful even if the other 1.299 million people don't have one. I'd download that if I had an iPhone because I listen to NPR a lot.
Yeah.
So it's like Flickr. Flickr was useful for the first person, and then it became really useful for all the subsequent people. Mm-hmm. But I could still upload my files and email my mom and say, "Go look at the pictures."
Yeah, we're doing Field of Dreams here. You know, it's you know, we obviously it has to be simple. It has to be real easy. If it's not easy, it's not gonna work. So we have to make it easy. That's one reason we'd want to do it on the public radio tuner first, if we can. So.
I want to jump in with a question from the back channel.
Okay.
So, relevant to this, which is from Benjamin Agaric, who says, I'm sorry, what?
I can ask.
Sorry.
Speaking of back, he's like,
wow, that's so weird.
Which one, though?
But now that you're in the room, you don't want to jump in.
No, I didn't at all. I jumped the line.
It was about the linked data RDF.
Yeah. That's the most important question, I think, is like, because you're working on building this and you're talking about like an RSS feed and tags. I mean, have you been thinking about and in contact with the linked data and semantic web needs and really movements at this point of, you know, putting out in a much richer way all the kinds of, you know, this is what I want, and other people can just pick it up. It really is the decentralized, you know, rich model that I think we're looking for.
The short answer is no, but the longer answer is sure. So four letters and not just two. I know some of those people, but we've not been directly in touch. Our approach basically so far has been not chumming the waters with publicity about what we're doing, but rather just see who comes, see who shows up. And so so far, for example, like the XRIXDI people have showed up. They have something that's like the semantic web in a sense that it's the data web rather than what Tim Berners-Lee wants to do. They're similar in certain ways. They cover different problem sets. Like the semantic web, though, that's not finished either. You know, so there's a lot of kind of like half-built Death Stars, you know, that are ready to blow up a planet after they get another few thousand parts in them, right? So, but it's, like I said, it's still early and it's still wide open to that. You know some people, you want to get them together with us? All for it. So I think, you know, everything's on the table here. We can do it any way we want. It's still early.
Does this boil down to more generational in terms of the youth of today? Are they really the ones that are going to be the change makers and game makers for this type of concept?
I don't know. I think again, it's going to be whoever shows up. I mean, obviously, we need to make stuff that benefits anybody.
Right.
I mean, this is one of those things that only runs in fifth gear, right? It's got to have to work for everybody. It's going to have to be like that. I think some things are going to be more young than others. You know, for those that are motivated to save the newspapers, that includes approximately nobody under 35. Right, and for those that, right, but for those that maybe say, for example, want to work on music or mashing things up or getting remunerated for, you know, artistic work or anything else in ways other than Google AdSense, that might include more younger people. And that's, I don't know. Richard?
What about, as well as building the demonstrations and the examples of this, trying to characterize the ecosystem you're looking to build, and then encouraging people to, I mean, you could consider having an outside certification, levels of kind of maturity towards VRM, or you could even self-certify. You could say, look, you know, I, a producer of software or services or whatever, have looked at this list, and it's a list of 15 things, and I'm at point number 8 on the list right now, and hopefully next year I'll be at point number 12, and one day I'll get to point number 15. And encourage, you know, you mentioned before about portable reputation from eBay. There's a company out there trying to do that, Trust Plus, local startup. Not doing great right now, but they might
be. Are you involved?
We're not involved. But yeah. I happen to know one of the principals there.
Yeah.
But the point is that they could probably say that they are, you know, 2/3 of the way along your spectrum, and that's useful to advertise.
Right.
And then an ecosystem can grow instead of just from the work of volunteers, or whatever, but you can actually encourage people to kind of pile in.
We've talked a lot about that. We should be doing it. If we had more bodies to throw at it, we could probably put that together faster.
We have a draft one.
Yeah.
It's on the wiki.
It's on the wiki. We have a lot of stuff on the wiki.
Which is projectvrm.org, by the way.
Yeah. If you go to projectvrm.org, it'll resolve to a much longer Harvard address, but it's a projectvrm.org. Yeah. If you look up certification there, if you look up, we've wanted to get a set of core principles. We actually list some on the front page. At least one of them is problematic, or I would have actually shown it today. It has to do with the individual owning rather than just simply being the source of their own data. The whole concept of owning one's own data is very problematic. Is it ownership? Is it control? You know, it's really hard to define. But we want to work on exactly that.
Right. There's an interesting model. Separate point, interesting model there, because the health people have got this principle about, you know, health data is created between the patient and the doctor, and there's some notion of each own that.
Right.
And there's a bunch of thinking been developed around that. Will knows.
Yeah, and that's Richard, by the way, has been very helpful in pointing me to people I haven't talked to yet, and I need to, because I really do think that the health issue is the biggest one of all. And I think it's the one that benefits most from that. So,
there's another group
plus 10.
Should look at. It's called data portability.
Oh, yeah.
And they're working on being able to give the data back where it belongs, which is at the user level, and making it possible for a user to bring data from one side to the other.
Right. Trent Adams and other people from data portability have been, we cross over a lot. There's a lot of overlap here. We've been in each other's meetings, and we know each other, and are kind of on the same larger team. So yes, they're great. We like data portability. Open Web Foundation too. I think you were first and then you over here.
I wonder how you balance the sort of explicit data sharing, for example, in advertising intent. If I go to Facebook or MySpace and say, I'm looking for a car, or if I go to cars.com and type in the type of a car, behind the scenes, those businesses are selling that data to car companies and advertisers,
right.
And, you know, versus if I come over and say post to my blog or someplace that's not doing that, how important is it that I, you know, I don't think people are generally aware that when they perform a search at cars.com or when they enter something into Facebook that that's being used in that way.
Yeah, we've had a number of people here, including I think one last week. Was it last week that I forget his name, but the amount of data that you're scattering all over the web at all times and in that fall into the custody of people who may not be good actors is enormous, and we generally don't know what's going on with that. the whole VRM idea to some degree came out of one use case for me, which is car rental. I almost always want my variables that I want in car rental are never what they're offering. In fact, for example, for a long time, I just wanted one that would play MP3 CDs because I wanted to be able, before iPods came along, I wanted to be able to burn a bunch of podcasts on an MP3 CD and play it. And only the Ford Focus had that for a while, and it was a decent car. But there's sometimes you say, I want a van that seats six and has a roof rack and four-wheel drive because I'm going skiing, and all they have is a van, right? But there are lots of variables like that that I would like to be able to assert, even if nobody's answering it. It's semi-public information. There's a customer out here that wants this particular combination of variables that is not in your very narrow roster of things that you're trying to sell now. And I think in the long run, as more customers can advertise their needs, as it were, to a narrow area like, say, car rentals, it will change those businesses in a way and probably discourage a lot of the profligate sharing of mostly useless information about why somebody showed up, always inferred in some ways. So, again, it's early and we'll see what happens. There's going to be a lot of experimentation involved. Back there and then over here.
Yeah, a question about personal fabrication. It seemed like one of the extensions to some of this was that if you had enough information, if people were sharing enough information, that you could essentially fabricate what people were interested in on the fly. Like the car company Scion has started doing more sort of customized cars based upon specifications and things like that. And you had mentioned that you didn't think that companies would be hurt by this, but it seemed like to some extent, if people got what they wanted, then branding would become less relevant. And that was something that people I know have been talking about recently.
Well, there's several points there. One is, having come from the advertising business a long time ago and having been a parishioner in the Church of Branding, I can't help but recall that branding is a concept that was created in the early 1930s. The concept was borrowed from the cattle business. The whole idea was that you burn your name or your image into the minds of people. You're P&G, you want to put one kind of soap in eight different boxes and sing about the difference. That's what branding was for a long time. It's been elevated a great deal more recently and kind of tidied up and made far more fancy. But the truth is that I think it comes down to reputation and it comes down to a bunch of other stuff like that. Yeah. I don't know. It's not, I've sort of like aggressively taken my head out of that space as much as I possibly can because it's icky, to me anyway. But I do think that in the long run, there will be far more customization, to get back to your first point. I think, people will be able to make more and more of whatever we want. They'll make cars to our spec. The car business is really interesting right now. There's the number of cars that are floating in large hulled ships in San Francisco Bay and other bays is enormous. The number of unsold cars laying around is just huge. And I think part of it is actually that they don't want them, because they're too standard. We actually want something that's not so standard. And
the whole business is weird. Have you heard of Local Motors that's building?
Yeah. And Robin Chase is going to be here later to start a Zipcar, by the way. And Zipcar is like a brilliant thing. There's going to be more stuff like that, I think. But, it isn't going to be mass customization. It's just going to be some companies are going to succeed by giving people what they want. And what people, we're all different. We all want different things. And that's kind of what the net's going to come down to eventually. Yes.
There are these sites out there. You reminded me of this when you were talking about rental cars. There's one for mortgages. There's one for car insurance that you put in your data, and somehow it goes out to a bunch of different companies, and they quote compete on
what's like lending tree for banks.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Well, imagine something like that for rental cars or any other market you want. I want to buy a car. I don't care what brand it is. I want it to have these features. It goes out there, and that, well, you could get an Infiniti i30, or you can get a Lexus, and different dealers will bid on that. That's a lot more of that stuff.
Yeah, and there can be one of those things, and that's an example of a service that we would like to be substitutable. In other words, you can't get it only from one place. That's another example of a kind of a personal RFP. It's less specified. We focus more on where customers know exactly what they want, and mostly in order to get advertising out of the room. Because as soon as you say, I'm not sure what I want, advertising comes in and says, I can figure it out for you. I can do collaborative filtering and a bunch of other fancy things. We'd rather get them out and just say, you know what, I've got money on the table for this thing now. But that's a perfect example of a user-driven service. And we want these to happen. We think it's going to be a huge business in that.
One big thing I don't think I heard you say yet, and it is some kind of way of having people work collaboratively and sort of a collective dealing with vendors. I don't think you're ever going to be on an equal relationship with a vendor like Verizon, where there's, you know, might just be one of them, if you're lucky, two offering a similar thing, unless people work together. And even for the idea of order and customizations, you know, even when you're going for the most individual thing, your interests are going to match up with someone else's, and there's the possibility that you can actually create it and make it happen. You can bring the demand into being if you can connect with other people. So I'm just wondering, like, the role for connecting people collectively in everything you're thinking about.
Okay, the reason I hadn't mentioned it is because I avoided it. And the reason I avoided it is because we don't want to start with the collective and move to the personal. We want to start with the personal and move to the collective, and it's still early. Obviously, VRM can't work unless a lot of people are doing it, right? So we need that kind of scale in the first place. We need a common set of tools that everybody has. Like, everybody has SMTP and HTML and HTTP and things like that. These are common things that everybody has. They're not individuated. We need a lot of people doing whatever it's going to be. But the second thing is we need ways for people to hook up together, too. But we see that as downstream. But the main thing we've tried to avoid, or I've especially tried to avoid, I'm probably more than anybody else, is the assumption that, you know, we, the poor consumer, up against the big bad Verizons of the world, have no power, and therefore we have to form a union and get together and thump on them and make them do what we want. To me, that form of supplication is defeat, and I think we have a form of victory that is actually a victory for the Verizons of the world as well, because they're not going to be able to survive without changing their business to meet what customers actually want instead of what they're guessing about them. So there's a whole bunch of middle grounds here we haven't touched on yet that have to do with the personal and the collective working together. It's just that our vector is kind of anchored in the personal, but it isn't against the collective. It's just the personal first, collective later. So over here, yeah.
You think it's likely that it seems to me that it's more likely that if you're right and companies are going to fail if they don't do this, it seems that a lot of
they're going to fail.
It seems like that a captive customer thing is going to be really hard to get.
It's going
to
be hard,
mindset.
Right.
And yeah. I would guess that I think it would be a miracle if you could get Comcast out of that mindset. And so I think it seems like I'll put it in the form of a question. Do you think it's likely that these things will happen, or is it a pipe dream? Is it likely that they will collapse in some way and other companies will spring up and maybe be more open to this kind of model?
I think all the above, actually. I think there'll be clueful companies, there'll be dumb companies, and I think there are a lot of leopards that won't change their stripes, right? There are a lot of, you know, and Comcast may be one of them. I don't know about Verizon. I've had interactions with people at Verizon that give me encouragement and both encouragement and discouragement. I know people who know people at Comcast that say, actually, there actually are some good things going on in there, and but at the same time, you know, most of these large companies think that they own you, and you're right. But I think that once they see how much intelligence they're not getting because they've locked it out, at some point people are going to add up the numbers and just say, what money, we call it MLOT, money left on the table. To answer the question back over here earlier, you know, what's going to make the difference is money. When like, there's a lot of money left on the table right now for a la carte cable TV. Everybody knows that. People want a la carte. They want complete a la carte. 500 channels is too complicated and weird. We want a la carte. That's what YouTube is. That's what these other things are. If you can do that better than the next guy, give us a la carte. And at some point, somebody will do the calculations and say, geez, we're just losing too many people, you know, or they're just coming at us with too many other requests. I don't know. But I think that all these companies are going to have to wake up and smell the demand rather than just statements by people like me. It's going to actually have to come in the form of demand that they haven't factored in yet. But hopefully we'll give them a fairly standard way of processing it.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been mainly talking about the commercial domain and how the service can create a more perfect marketplace in a way where customers mm-hmm. can say what they want. What about the cultural domain or NGOs? What opportunities do you see there for organizations?
I think they're huge. I mentioned earlier what Britt Blazer is doing with government relationship management. I think that there was a lot of wonderful experience that came out of the Obama campaign for participation by individuals in it. A lot of it was actually very corporatized in a way. We have ways of making you, you know, a supporter and all that. But but at the same time, there's a side to governance that is individual. There's a wonderful outfit in the UK called mysociety.org, I'm not sure. But they have a site called fixmystreet.com or fixmystreet.org. And people just take pictures of their potholes and put them up. And they come and they get fixed, and it's all happening outside of any government organization. But the government's actually been quite, you know, enthused by it and responsive to it because the people are speaking that way. I think it's inevitable that organizations of various kinds, NGOs. I mentioned churches earlier. Probably not so much with churches, but libraries, God knows what. I mean, I know NGOs are coming to my mind for a second, but I think that, you know, organizations are comprised of people, and people are not all, don't all fall into policy. They will be collected around one thing or another, but being able to express what one is looking for in a fairly standard way that can be gathered among a bunch of people, I think will work in any kind of thing. So a lot of what we've talked about, not a lot, but Renee and I have talked, she's not here, but about just RM for relationship management. Put another letter in front of it if you like. There's any number you can stick there. The long-term promise of the net is that the supply side and the demand side find better ways to get along, whether it's in a pure financial market context or in a more social context. You know, so that would be the sort of bottom line there. So here we are, 45 seconds away from the deadline.
We'll fill it with applause.
Thank you.